Mike McEntee here on AM 950. How you doing? Happy Tuesday to you. We are almost done. Almost done with February, because when you get February out of the way, then you can, the next month has spring in it. And isn't that a much more pleasant thought to have? We're going to work on pleasant thoughts here today. I've got a real pleasant thought for you. March 10th, we've been talking about it here for quite some time. We got the Blue State Ball coming up. And today, our crack promotion team came up with a new promotion. We are going to be giving away a pair of tickets to the Blue State Ball, but the VIP tickets. Now, you don't call in to win these. That would be too simple. It would be too simple. You have to subscribe to our newsletter. It comes out every Thursday. It's got some funny articles in it. It's got some great, you know, stuff about advertisers, you know, all sorts of good things. Occasionally, you know, we highlight interviews from this program and also from Matt's program. So things you kind of really do want to know. So it's a good thing to get in your email. But if you subscribe to it, and I think all you have to do is to subscribe, I think you just go to our homepage. I think you just go to the homepage at am950radio.com. But if you subscribe to the newsletter, there's going to be a code word in it. And then you mail that code word to comment at am950radio.com, and then you're entered in the contest. Code word. I mean, Hunter, are you in on this? Are we like, is this a secret code word?
It'll be very obvious in the newsletter on Thursday.
It's very obvious. We don't need a secret decoder ring or anything like that. No decoding. It's just a secret word that you got to know to send an email to us. And then you could win these tickets. These tickets are like $100 each.
Yep.
And so there's a pair. So this is like a $200 value prize that you could win just for subscribing to our newsletter and entering the contest. So I don't know. It's kind of a no-brainer. Something that you should do. We've been talking about the Blue State Ball. We got word the other day that Rebecca Otto, who is our state auditor and also a candidate for governor, is going to be one of the speakers. She's one of the just announced speakers that's going to be there. And of course, we've got Tom Hartman and Norman Goldman and are going to be there as well. I'm showing up. I don't think I'm speaking. I'm just sitting in the corner and waving at people. But and Matt's going to be there. Matt is always verbose. You won't miss Matt in the room. But so we're all going to be there, and the tickets are going pretty fast. Hunter, you just worked on you. I didn't realize you edited video too. You've got a video that you're putting out about the whole thing. So.
Yeah, it's just a quick video promo about it, past pictures from other Blue State Balls, and you're actually the narrator.
Oh, I'm the narrator. I did that. Okay. But that's also out there. So you know, if you want to encourage your friends to go, you maybe send them that video. I think that thing is going to be up on Facebook. If it's not, it'll be over on the Facebook page soon, I'm sure. But pass it around. You know, get your friends to go if you're already going. And if you haven't gone, you know, take a look at that. It's interesting stuff. Anyway, stuff coming up on the show today. We're going to dig into the 8th Congressional District because it has become a real mess is the wrong word. Let's just say competitive. Let's say competitive amongst those in the DFL and in the Republican Party, probably too, eventually. There's only one declared candidate there. But on the DFL side, we seem to have a new candidate almost every day. And somebody says they're running. Somebody says they're not. It's a fast changing scene. So we have Aaron Brown, who is, you know, my go-to guy in the 8th Congressional District, knows the politics, knows the people, knows the candidates. We're going to talk to him in a little while about who's in the race, who isn't, what that means, where this is all going. So, you know, again, we have four seats here in play in Minnesota this year. We have CD1, where Tim Walz, it's an open seat. CD8, where Nolan's leaving, that's an open seat. And then CD2 and CD3, which are held by the Republicans, those are under fire and may not, you know, Eric Paulson and Jason Lewis. I think those are areas that Barack Obama won last time. I think Hillary Clinton won last time. And so they may, you know, it's not a given that they're going to win. And there's some strong candidates coming up on the DFL side. So we've got four seats here that I think everybody agrees on both parties are not safe. And there's going to be a lot of money, a lot of campaigning, a lot of things going on. It's going to be a very interesting political season. It's making Minnesota kind of ground. It, they've been promoting ground zero of the election. No, I can tell you there's a lot of other ones. The Senate race in Arizona, which could be two Senate races out there, depending on what happens to John McCain over the, you know, with his illness. That is probably going to be the main focus of what's going on, because the Senate is much closer right now than the House. But four races here in Minnesota that could determine whether Democrats flip the House or not are going to be very, it's going to be, a lot of people are paying attention to that. Some things that, talking about paying attention to things, something that really kind of just slipped under the radar for most of the media last night is that Governor Dayton signed the legislative budget. And this is, remember, Governor Dayton line item vetoed the legislative budget at the end of the session, and it was basically to force Republicans to come back to negotiate a lot of things with him. Well, the Republicans have not come back to negotiate a lot of those things with him. And Governor Dayton, after a court fight saying that he could do this, the legislature came back, passed a clean bill, refunding themselves, and Dayton signed it last night. So this whole drama ends with a whimper. I'm not sure what was accomplished out of it, but you know, at least Governor Dayton has established that he has the right to veto the legislative funding. Now, he probably won't have a chance to do that again because this is his last term. In fact, I saw a note today that his last State of the State address is scheduled for next month, which, by the way, we'll be carrying live over at theuptake.org if you want to watch that. But his term is drawing to a close, and so he does not get to use that power. Future governors might, whether they're a Republican or a Democrat. So, you know, again, a lot of money, a lot of time, a lot of things were expended trying to make something happen here. And as far as I can tell, and somebody please correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think the governor got any concessions out of the Republicans on doing any of that. Other stories here. Texas teachers, and I want to make an adjustment here on my machine so you can hear this, though. But Texas teachers, just like Minnesota teachers, are not too happy about what President Trump has been proposing. They're saying that arming teachers to deter school shooters is a bad idea. And I think a lot of folks, as we've been taking phone calls here over the last week, practically, have been saying that. Yesterday, we heard from an Apple Valley High School teacher named Dennis Drawn, who's also a soldier. And he says, as a soldier, I know something about military weapons, and I know any plan to arm teachers to stop a man with an AR-15 is foolish and dangerous. And if you say otherwise, you are not listening to veterans. It was quite a good speech. It was part of the Saturday rally that happened at the Capitol. If you want to see that thing again, we've got the whole thing over at theuptake.org that you can watch. Well, today, Texas teachers are weighing in on that proposal. Clay Robinson is a spokesperson for the Texas State Teachers Association, the TSTA, which represents thousands of Texas school teachers. It's one of the largest school teacher associations in the United States, and says despite what activists may believe, firepower is not the answer to school violence.
Cure gun violence in the classroom by putting more guns in schools. You sell more guns that way, but you don't address the problem of gun violence.
Yeah. And for several years, the NRA and other groups have promoted the idea of having teachers and other staff carry firearms to protect students in case of an attack. But Robinson says the TSTA and its parent group, the National Education Association, believe lawmakers should instead focus on ways to end the violence, such as passing common sense gun laws and improving mental health care. He says while some small Texas school districts do allow teachers with proper training to carry guns in the classroom, they are the exception rather than the rule.
You can train teachers to get a handgun license, but most of our members that we have talked to do not want that. They do not want to be put in the position of having to have a gunfight with an armed intruder.
So I don't know where Donald Trump's proposal here is really going to go, but I don't, for teachers right now, teachers just do not like this. And speaking of Trump, Jared Kushner, his son-in-law, who's worn these dueling hats for more than a year as his senior advisor and son-in-law, well, today he was stripped of his access to the nation's top secrets. This was after his security clearance was downgraded. Kushner, along with other White House officials who have been operating on interim clearances, had their access altered last week after Chief of Staff John Kelly stipulated new changes to the security clearance system. Aides who had previously operated on top secret interim clearances saw their access changed to secret, a classification for less sensitive material. Dozens of Trump officials have operated on interim clearances since Trump took office more than a year ago. Kelly has grown frustrated with the high number of aides without permanent access and has worked to shrink the number of temporary clearances. He issued a memo last week spelling out the changes to the system, which gained new scrutiny after domestic allegations against former aide Rob Porter surfaced this month, who, yes, had that top secret security clearance, apparently. And if he had that, and if you followed the Rob Porter story, you know that there were incriminating photos of him out there. And the whole idea or the whole problem is something like that can be leveraged against you to, blackmail you. You know that can happen. So that's, again, this administration, we have not seen this type of stuff going on in any other administration, and it is getting frustrating for a lot of people. One other note here out of Washington today. The long shot fight to save net neutrality kind of officially started today. A group of senators officially has formed to overturn last year's net neutrality repeal. This is now the FCC's new rules have been published in the Federal Register. Today, Senator Ed Markey introduced a long-promised resolution of disapproval under the Congressional Review Act. Now, the CRA lets Congress strike down a new rule with a simple majority vote. And the bill currently has 50 supporters. If you're doing your math right, you know that's one vote shy of a majority. Now, Senate Democrats have been raising support for this since last year, but the Federal Register publication starts a 60-day legislative countdown clock for voting on it. And the bill goes to a committee for consideration first, but after 20 days, a group of 30 senators can force the Senate to put the thing on the calendar. And right now, they've got more than enough co-sponsors to force a vote this way, but to pass it, they need to win over one more Republican in addition to Senator Susan Collins from Maine, who has already expressed support for the move. Now, Tina Smith, Minnesota senator, was today in Washington, explained how net neutrality helps people in Minnesota.
I want to give you one example of why net neutrality matters so much. This is an example from a small town in northern Minnesota called Fergus Falls. I met there an entrepreneur, a father. He and his wife and their young children wanted to move back to the farmhouse that his wife's grandmother had once lived in. But he worked in finance in the Twin Cities. But because that farmhouse was connected to broadband, he was able to run his business that had transactions all over the world. He was able to run it from that farmhouse. And then at the end of the day, if the weather wasn't too bad, he could walk out to the end of his long driveway and meet his kids when they got off from school. He was able to do that all because of a free and open internet, net neutrality. And he was able to do that because no big company, thousands of miles away, got to decide how his business worked, got to decide what content he had access to, and got to decide how fast it comes to him. I strongly support this. I have only been in this Senate for around 2 months, but I am so proud to join my colleagues, including Senator Klobuchar, a great consumer champion from Minnesota, to provide another vote for net neutrality.
Now, that vote for net neutrality, though, is a long shot legislative fix. If it gets to the Senate, it's going to have to pass the House, where it has only 150 of the required 218 votes so far. Assuming it gets past that, Donald Trump would probably likely veto the measure. Long shot, but keep calling your representatives. Keep, obviously get your senators on your side. Let them know that you need them to support net neutrality, or we could face, an open internet that we could just be saying goodbye to. Hey, coming up next, we are going to talk about this 8th Congressional District and what's happening up there. We're going to check in with Aaron Brown about all the candidates. We'll get who's running and who isn't and who might. That's all coming up here next on the Mike McEntee Show.
Turn to Auto Technical with your vehicle donation. We have families waiting for a car. Over 85% of unemployed are successful in finding and keeping a job if they have dependable transportation. A car plus a job equals a life changed. 612-919-5526. We have families waiting for a car. 919-5526 or autotech.org.
Did you know the average February temperature in Minnesota is under 16 degrees? Well, here's a better February number. You can get a brand new furnace from Standard Heating and Air Conditioning for just $2,300 this February. Just $2,300 for all the cozy comfort and reliability of a brand new furnace. Don't wait. This offer ends when February does. Some restrictions apply. Visit standardheating.com for details. Standard Heating and Air Conditioning, the comfort you deserve.
I first fell in love with Toyotas when I got my RAV4. It was perfect. And now that it's SUV month at Rudy Luther Toyota, you can fall in love yourself. Right now, Rudy Luther Toyota has 290 RAV4s in stock with 0% financing for 60 months or 0.9% financing for 72. The RAV4 is sharp with the safety features you need. It's perfect size for getting around town, and hands down, it's the best off-road vehicle I've ever driven. See for yourself during SUV month at Rudy Luther Toyota, 5 miles west of downtown Minneapolis on 394.
Hello, humans. This is me, Ellie Krug, with Ellie 2.0 on Monday mornings at 7:30. This Monday, I'll talk about a group of idealists in real time, the Parkland, Florida high school students who are reshaping the landscape relative to the sale of assault rifles. These kids, most unable to even vote, are doing what others have been unable to do. Get us focused on guns. I've got a vision for a better world where everyone has a place at the table. Ellie 2.0. Engaging in real on AM 950.
Welcome back to the Mike McEntee Show. Minnesota's 8th Congressional District will have a new representative in 2019. That much we know. Democrat Rick Nolan's announcement earlier this month that he isn't running for re-election has set off a scramble in the DFL party. The lineup of who is running and who is not has been shifting almost daily. Joining us to sort out the complexities of the race is the man we turn to for Northern Minnesota politics, blogger, author, and radio show host Aaron Brown. Aaron, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Good to be here, Mike.
Good to have you here. Since the last time we talked, we've seen a former TV anchor get into the race, a former state rep return home to run, and a lot of people take themselves out of contention. Let's talk about who is running right now for this.
Sure. Well, the race began, of course, Rick Nolan was seeking re-election, but he had a challenger for the DFL endorsement, and that would be the Homeland Security analyst Leah Pfeiffer from Ashanti County, originally from Two Harbors. She is in the race. Joining her after that was Kirsten Kennedy, Kirsten Hagen Kennedy, mayor of North Branch, again in the southern part of the 8th District. And then Joe Radinovich, former state representative from Crosby, served one term and kind of famously lost re-election after voting for gay marriage, and kind of was well known for that vote and its expense. And then Michelle Lee, longtime Duluth TV news anchor for the NBC affiliate in Duluth. She retires last year, and now she's running for Congress. And then, of course, in the same amount of time, we've had some people get out of the race, and we might yet see more this week get into it.
Let's go over some of those people who are running, because, you know, for those of us not familiar with northern Minnesota, not living up there, a lot of those names aren't familiar, but a couple I think would stick out that would have name recognition. Michelle Lee, if she's, you know, she's been on TV here for 30 years, that seems to give her a leg up in the race because just more people know her.
Yeah, and that would be true in the northern part of the district, the Iron Range and Duluth and places like that. Unfortunately for her, the district is now about 50% in the Twin Cities media market. The southern part of the district gets their news from Minneapolis and St. Paul. So she's not as well known in the southern part of the district. However, she's from Moose Lake, which is kind of on the southern edge of the district, the south side of the north side, I guess you could say. And so she does have the ability to get south rather easily as this campaign goes on. And so, yeah, but she comes in with a lot of name recognition. The others are mostly new to at least most of the voters. You know, Radinovich had his famous vote, so some people in DFL circles know him, but he's probably not well-known personally outside of his former legislative district. And Leah Pfeiffer has been building and working on a campaign, but mostly because it's an endorsement campaign, has been mostly talking to DFL activists. A lot of rank-and-file voters who might vote in a primary are still learning about her. And Kirsten Kennedy is not very well known outside of North Branch. She was Rick Nolan's guest at the State of the Union address here last month, but she is, you know, I still haven't heard much from her other than that she's running. So, yeah, a lot of names that people don't know very well, and that's going to be the story here, I think. A large pile of candidates who aren't super well-known, trying to parse apart an electorate that is, you know, volatile, as the 8th District is.
And usually we have an endorsement in the DFL, and that kind of determines what's going to happen in the primary. But this time around, with so many candidates, everything being announced so late, I would suspect that an endorsement, which I think takes 60% of the vote, is probably not going to happen.
Right. Yep.
Yeah, that's probably not going to happen. So name recognition and appealing to the general electorate here, at least those who are going to show up at the primary, that's a larger subset than those who go to caucuses, I think, or
yeah.
Maybe a different subset. That's going to be a whole different ballgame.
Well, it will be. And regarding the endorsement, I think one candidate has an outside chance at getting the endorsement, and that would be Leah Pfeiffer, just because she's been organizing the delegate campaign before this all happened. I heard reports from Pine County and some of the smaller counties who are having their conventions earlier that she's doing quite well in the delegate take coming out of those conventions. The big ones are yet ahead, and you know, I think she'll probably do well in Duluth because she's been working in Duluth a lot, but she might not do as well on the Iron Range. And it kind of comes down to the different ideological splits in the party and in the district. But I think Leah Pfeiffer has an outside chance, but all the other candidates will be making moves to block an endorsement if they can't get it themselves.
Now, we have candidates who are kind of hanging out there who might run, and we didn't actually hear from one this week, but we heard from somebody else who wasn't going to run who wants that candidate to run. Tell me about that.
Yeah, Jeff Anderson, who ran in 2012 when the seat was when the DFL seat was open to run against Chip Kravac. He's been in the rumor mill for a possible candidacy to run again. He's been Nolan's district director, former city councilor, former business person. He owns several businesses, popular cafes, and his husband in Duluth. So he's very, very well known. He opted not to run yesterday. He announced that he wasn't running in a pretty unusual way, and that he endorsed a candidate who wasn't even in the race yet, and that would be State Representative Jason Metza from Virginia. He's the Iron Range labor guy, and that's probably the quickest way to label him. And he is not in the race yet, but I'm hearing rumblings that he will be soon, and I think Jeff Anderson's announcement is part of that process. So that if Metza gets in, you got five candidates for the DFL. And as I wrote this morning, they're aligned along a spectrum of beliefs about the most controversial issue in the district, which is mining and environmental issues. And so voters will have their choice of many different positions if that's their thing. But at the same time, there's a lot of people who are making their decisions for other reasons. Maybe they're supporting their local candidate. Maybe they're supporting a well-known name that they like. You know, maybe healthcare is their thing, and they're going to be parsing their positions on that. So a lot of moving parts, and it's interesting that no one candidate appears to be a front runner. If Leah Pfeiffer can somehow pull off the endorsement, maybe she could be considered a slight front runner. But for the most part, they're all in the mix here. It's a big pack, and we just got done watching the Olympics and those cross country ski races where you see the people all packed together. You don't know who's going to emerge at the end. That's what this is right now. Somebody's going to emerge, but we won't really know maybe until the day of the election, you know, as the returns come in.
You know, I was reading your analysis about this, and you had an interesting point. You know, we're kind of lacking some bigger names here, and I don't know who they would be, but one of the things that may be preventing people from running, you write, is that the district is so volatile.
Yeah. And I had a few theories on why the race was the way it was. And one of them is, you know, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, if you run and win in 2018, you're the biggest target in the country in 2020. And even if you survive 2020, you will be in 2022. There's a strong, the strong chance that you're just going to get thrown out on your butt when the mood changes, you know, and the mood is changing rapidly. You know, the district voted for Trump in 2016. Nolan claimed that they had internal polls showing a DFL candidate generically ahead this time. That's what Nolan's campaign was saying anyway. And so it's volatile. You know, Nolan won comfortably in 2012 and tight races in 2014 and 16. So, you know, it's going to be a lot of fundraising, a lot of work. And that's why I also suggested that perhaps, you know, we're seeing two kinds of candidates in this mix for the most part. There's a few exceptions. But for the most part, they're somewhat young, or at least they don't have children yet. Or there are people who have done something else for a long time and have either recently retired or are closer to retirement age. Not necessarily old, I won't use that word, but they've done something for a long time and they're moving on from it. And it's not a lot of people in the middle who have young families. In fact, that's the reason why the big names said they wouldn't run. Don Ness, Emily Larson, mayor of Duluth, Tony Sertich. These are names that have been around that I think are recognizable to most of the district, and none of them want to run. And they all have young families, and that's the main reason why. And so we have a very inexperienced, politically inexperienced anyway, crew running on both sides. Pete Stauber's a county commissioner, but he's relatively new to politics. Obviously, he's been opinionated for a long time, but he's the Republican. And then Stuart Mills, who was the challenger the last two times, he may get into the Republican race. He's a business owner, not necessarily a political mind in his earlier years. So it's an outsider kind of field. It's volatile, a lot of outsiders, and somebody brand new, brand spanking new, is going to end up winning this thing.
Now, Stuart Mills, even though he doesn't have a lot of government experience, has had the experience of running in two campaigns that were, you know, reasonably close. Does that really, I mean, as Republicans look around, I mean, they have to be salivating, thinking, well, if we don't have the incumbent, Stuart Mills could just, you know, win this thing. Of course, Stuart Mills and the Republican establishment aren't exactly, you know, best buddies these days.
That's the Republicans' conundrum, because Republicans are salivating for the race. They think they can win. But they've got Pete Stauber, who's not really been tested on a big race before. He's got a great story. He's got a great resume. He'll make a great ad, probably. But he's not been tested in debates and fundraisers and the endless grind of the congressional race. And he may or may not, if he performs well, obviously he'd be a great candidate. But if he doesn't, then they may squander an opportunity. You get Mills, who has the experience of running, who can raise money, who has money and can spend it, but has underperformed the Republican ticket. Like, you know, Trump won the 8th district by 14 points, and he lost the 8th district. That means, you know, 25% of all Trump voters crossed over to vote for Rick Nolan. That's amazing, you know, and that kind of reflects on perhaps Mills' weakness as a candidate in some ways. So the Republicans don't have a perfect option, and I think there will be some who want the new face of Pete Stauber, fresh attempt, and then some who see Mills as the guy who has earned it. They liked Mills before, and they like that he's fighting with the Republican establishment. The establishment is the enemy, no matter what party you're in. Everybody hates the establishment. That's why I say somebody's going to come out of this who probably isn't the predicted name.
And, of course, that person, whoever wins, is going to be the establishment the next time around. So the churn,
exactly.
I think, is just going to continue. So Aaron Brown, you can find what he writes over at MinnesotaBrown.com. We turn to him for, you know, insight and analysis of what's going on in the 8th Congressional District. And, Aaron, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us today.
Sure thing, Mike. Thanks.
Week, Newsweek published a story suggesting that social media bots controlled by the right wing may have played a part in the public pressure that caused Senator Al Franken to resign. The story was pulled after about 48 hours. Is there a story there, and why was it pulled? Coming up next, we'll talk to the Newsweek reporter who wrote it. That's next on The Mike McEntee Show.
Tom Hartman here, letting you know that Better Energy is finally affordable. With All Energy Solar, Minnesota's number one local home solar provider, you can go solar with little or no money down. Qualified property owners could even see a return on investment in less than 1 year. Xcel Energy's Solar Rewards Incentive Program is available first come, first serve, and federal tax credits are available for a very limited time. Schedule your free solar assessment today. Visit allenergysolar.com. That's allenergysolar.com.
Have you got your tickets yet for the Blue State Ball? Time is running out. They're going fast. Hi, it's Mike McEntee. I plan to be at the Blue State Ball on March 10th. Will you be there? Norman Goldman will be. So will Tom Hartman, who will be signing his books. So will our own Matt McNeil, Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Fry, gubernatorial candidate Rebecca Otto, Paul Metza from AM 950's Wall of Power Radio Hour will be playing the music for a jamming good time. Food from D'Amico, Minnesota Brewed Drinks from Obibulous, you won't want to miss it. Mark your calendar now for March 10th at the Blaisdell. VIP reception with hors d'oeuvres and a hosted bar at 5:30 p.m. and general admission at 7 p.m. And then get set for some inspirational speeches from some great speakers. It's made possible with the help of our sponsors, Howling for Wolves, Common Good Books, and Northern Sun. So go to am950radio.com right now and get your tickets for the Blue State Ball. See you there.
Moe's Tax Service, family-owned and operated since 1971, providing a full spectrum of tax preparation and associated services. Think about it. Why would you take your most important financial information to a franchise operation with a cheap basic package that goes up dramatically once you're in the door? You can find out all you need to know about Moe's by visiting www.moestax.com. That's M-O-H-S-Tax.com. Or call them at 612-721-2026. Don't be a blockhead. Go to the professionals at Moe's Tax Service.
Turn to Auto Technical with your vehicle donation. Even though Auto Technical is a small nonprofit, we have helped more families with transportation than any organization in Minnesota. Since 94, we have reconditioned donated vehicles so they have a higher tax benefit. Call Richard at 612-919-5526. 612-919-5526. Or autotech.org.
Welcome back to the Mike McEntee Show. Senator Al Franken resigned after public pressure surrounding allegations of sexual misconduct. But some of that pressure, was it brought to you by social media bots? Newsweek recently published a story titled How an Alt-Right Bot Network Took Down Al Franken. It detailed how an alt-right bot network based in Japan played a role in stoking anger against him. Joining us is the reporter who did that story, Nina Burley. Nina, welcome to the program.
Thank you. How are you?
I am fine. Now, before we get into the story, I think we have to do a caveat or an explanation. Newsweek has retracted your story and taken it down. Why is that?
Well, we decided to retract it, and I participated in that decision because the research that I based it on is not validated by other IT experts. And I was unable to get the person who did the research to answer some questions that came up after we published the story and after it went viral, unfortunately. So I will regret to my dying day that I didn't call my IT experts, the people I usually call, before we put the story up. But the material looked good. The source, and I'll tell you who he has, sent me screenshots and other information that made his account of how this played out look real to me. And so I wrote the story, and we started to get pushback on Monday. Wait, President's Day, it went up So the next day, well, that afternoon, we started to get pushback from one person who was mentioned in the article as having had her, one of her stories picked up by this botnet and spewed out, one of her anti-Franken stories. And she's a progressive woman. So she put, she started saying that it was wrong, that they hadn't, you know, that this article of hers had not been used in that way. And then we went back and did a full search of all the tweets done by these tweet bots. And we believe that it is a botnet, that it's they're fake Twitters. They're not human. But what we couldn't determine after looking at all the tweets or many of the tweets from some of these individual tweet bot, Twitter bots was whether or not they were politically pointing at Al Franken and Roy Moore and sort of taking a concerted and very clear point of view from the right to take down Al Franken. What we realized was that the screenshots that the source had sent me had been sort of curated so that it looked like all of the bots were tweeting about Al Franken at the same time. But what he had done was a kind of search so that he pulled up all of the Al Franken tweets, and there were a lot of them. But if you started to look at the bots, if you went back into the history of the tweets, Twitter bots, and you saw what they were tweeting that day, you could see that they were tweeting a lot of other stuff. And they have some, one of the things, one of their tweets had to do with Bernie Sanders, and it wasn't anti-Bernie Sanders, and there were lots of sort of random news-related tweets thrown in there. So I went back to the source, and I said, look, you're an expert on botnets. I'm not. I'm trusting your experience and your analysis here. Can you explain to me why they would be tweeting so much other material that doesn't have to do with Al Franken? And how can you still make the case that they are focusing on Al Franken? And he couldn't give me a satisfactory answer. And I gave him a night to consult with his people. And in the morning, that was Tuesday morning or Wednesday morning. At that time, I woke up and I said, we can't leave the story up because there's too much pushback. We had Snopes. We had some other people who had consulted with IT experts who looked at it and said, doesn't look right. I had contacted some of my experts by that time, and my experts looked at it and said, you know, it could be either way, but it's definitely not clear enough that you can make this case that this was a Al Franken directed takedown. Now, what the source was saying was that, well, these botnets, they're not stupid. They try to hide their tracks. So they will tweet a lot of garbage, a lot of Kim Kardashian news and so on. And then they'll squeeze in the thing that they want and they'll get it in. But it just didn't look like that's what was going on. And so we retracted it. And at some point, you know, I was also picking up from people that in the sort of anti-Trump world, which is where this source was sort of working, he claims to do research into election fraud, and he and his team of experts sort of are looking at data and elections. And that's where he started. And his material regarding elections had also been challenged by sort of other members of the Trump resistance. And I could see that on Twitter. And so I just felt that he wasn't, I wasn't confident in the source. And I will, as I said, I'm deeply sorry that I published it without having gotten other input before it went up. It was just a case of, you know, it was President's Day and it was, you know, people were on vacation and it looked real. And I talked to him and I talked to him for an hour before I put it up and I trusted him. And in journalism, you're only as good as your sources and well, actually as good as your sources and your own judgment. And I would regard this as something of a lapse. I don't usually make mistakes like this and I'm deeply sorry for it, for misleading, people who thought that, that it, you know, this is a reason for Al Franken's demise. Now, putting that aside, I do think there is no doubt in my mind that Roger Stone had something to do with bringing Leanne Tweeden forward. And that's clear because he tweeted the day before she came out, the day or two before, you know, the tweet that, paraphrasing, tomorrow, you know, Al Franken's time in the barrel draws near or something.
Yeah, I think time in the barrel is about to come.
Picture.
Yeah. Yep.
So there, so that with that sort of little fact pattern, it seemed reasonable that he would have been involved in, because we think that he was involved with these other tweet networks and tweet bots and sort of cyber, I don't know what you would call it, cyber dirty tricks, that he might have been involved in this. And the source had evidence that these two sites, these two fake news sites, were set up right before he spoke, right before Roger Stone's tweet, and then a week later. And so those two sites, he kind of created this network, evidence of network, of a network, because those sites were being tweeted by these tweet bots. So the timing, suspicious, but we just can't prove that these weren't just commercial aggregating, a commercial aggregating kind of money-making operation of some kind or something else. We don't really know. We do know that the sites were taken down, I think, within a day of my article going up. So it's all very murky, but I didn't want to leave a story up that was misleading people. It had gone viral, which is unfortunate, and we're going to continue to investigate it. We're going to investigate the source. We're going to find out, what his other work has been like, and what other people think of it. We're going to do some analysis, and I may write something about it again when we have a better idea of what we did wrong and what he did wrong. But I think for now, I think it's pretty clear that we cannot get enough experts on board, reputable experts who will sort of second this person's research. And your listeners can look online and see it. His name is, he tweets by Mike Farb. His name is Mike Goldfarb. And he operates an organization called Unhack the Vote. All of those things can be found on Twitter. And his description of what he found is still up on Medium, and he's still standing by it.
We're speaking with Nina Burley, who is a Newsweek reporter who wrote this story about how an alt-right bot network took down Al Franken. It's, the story itself has been taken down from Newsweek. But as we've been talking about this, you're trying to figure out if there's political motivation and who's behind it. Let's set those aside for the moment and just say, did this tweet bot campaign have any real impact on what was going on? Can that be traced at all?
Well, no, I mean, I can't, because we recognize that there were many, many other tweets going on that had nothing to do with him. We can't say that this was, it was part of the sort of greater tsunami of information that was being tweeted out about Al Franken. I do not have evidence that it was I don't know what percentage of sort of all the tweets about Al Franken were coming from this particular site. We do know that they had 54, they put out 54 different articles or retweeted 54 different articles in this time period, anti-Franken articles. But, you know, he was being attacked from all sides at that point, right? So there were many, many articles being written, and there was much discussion. And I can't answer whether this evidence, these tweets that were part of this sort of tweet bot were in number strong enough to by themselves have pushed the needle. I mean, certainly a number of articles being retweeted about somebody's scandal is pushing the needle to some extent, right? But again, we cannot say that all of those retweets were and tweetings of articles were directed at him for political reasons, or whether the botnet was simply diving into this trend of trending Al Franken stories to get more attention to their sites.
The bots that were used in this, your story said they were based in Japan, and that the timing on this was, again, suspect.
The sites were registered in Japan.
Okay.
So we're talking about two things. We're talking about two fake news sites, Bodhi.us.me and RealUSA.site. Those two sites were registered in Japan. The botnet, the bots, the tweet bots, all had between 40 and 60 followers, and all of them, again, according to my source, all of them had as their first follower either a Japanese or a Russian, according to him. So those are the, you know, that's the basic story, and whether or not the tweets are we don't know who the Twitter owner, we don't know who's operating this botnet. We don't know, you know, I think we've entered an age where the use of Twitter bots and the use of sock puppets, let's say, in social media has just proliferated. And you know, I've covered politics for a long time. The 2016 election was won partly on a superior social media strategy. We all agree on that. It may not have been won entirely on that, but it was won partly because of a superior social media strategy that involved bots and fake news. When I did a story on an aspect of that back in June, I was doing a story on Facebook and Cambridge Analytica, and I interviewed a Republican national RNC digital operative, a very high-ranking digital guy. And I said, you know, what do you see coming up in the future? Like, how is this going to change the way political strategy is plotted out? And he said, number one, you're going to see a lot more bots. He admitted it. And you know this is true because in any political cycle, if one party, let's say Obama in 2008, was able to advance using what was perceived as superior social media tactics, and that's true of 2008, the opposite party is going to try to better that, right?
Of course.
So these botnets are not just going to be deployed by Russians or, you know, the Republicans. They're going to be deployed by everybody who wants their candidate to win.
I mean, or not to win.
They were created to sell stuff. They were created, this whole thing is created, all of social media, in a sense, all of this stuff is created to grease the wheels of commerce and to sell more stuff. That's what Facebook ads were for. Well, sell more stuff. You can find the exact person using Facebook and using the data points. Now they have 400 data points on every American. You can use that if you're trying to sell your widget, and you want, and that those data points in those Facebook pages and those Twitters can identify who is the 40-year-old dad, you know, working on his house who needs that particular screwdriver that you're selling, and they can target it to them. So that's what this was all. This all started with, let's try to sell more stuff, and this is a great way to sell more of our stuff and get our product to the exact right consumer. And so politics is just using this to sell not just candidates, but ideas and strategies and issues. And it's being used all the time now. It's being used on issues as well. So I think knowing that and then having this information put in front of me, I thought that it was plausible, but I can't, after consulting again with you know, IT experts and also talking to the original source who did the research, I cannot vouch for it being 100% accurate. And we can't have a story up there telling people that this is what happened unless we can get 100% accuracy, or at least closer to that than where I'm at right now.
We've been speaking with Nina Burley, who is a reporter who was writing the story about how the alt-right bot network took down Al Franken. The story itself has been pulled from the website for the reasons we've just been discussing, and it just points out how difficult it has become to cover politics, to be covering technology, kind of all mixed together. It's an interesting mix that just makes for the work of journalists much, much tougher and makes your job much tougher, my job much tougher, but we'll look forward to seeing what the investigation that Newsweek continues to do here shows up. Nina, I appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much for giving me a chance to explain. And again, I'm sorry if your readers were confused, and we will do our best to clear up the murk.
Well, coming up next here on the Mike McIntyre Show, could it be the big thaw on gun legislation in Minnesota? Some breaking news next year on AM 950.
What could be more Russian than Matryoshka, the nesting doll? I welcome you to see one of the largest collection of Matryoshka in the world, now on display at the Museum of Russian Art. A stunning range of sizes, types, and eras are represented, showing how this iconic souvenir has evolved over the last 120 years. Our thanks to Target for sponsoring this extraordinary exhibition, open daily. Find out about all our exhibitions and events at tmora.org, that is tmora.org.
I'm Adam Jennings, and I approve this message. Some people say weapons don't kill people, people kill people. But if that were the case, then we wouldn't care if North Korea had nukes, would we? You ever think about that? Let's get real. Each year, gun violence hurts nearly 50,000 Americans, including 4,000 kids. And while some politicians act like tough guys, they're too chicken to stand up to the NRA, who gave Eric Paulson an A-plus rating, along with a check for $20,000. He's working for them, not us. I think any congressman who has an A-plus rating from the NRA has the blood of these children on their hands. NRA, give me an F, because I believe in fighting for kids, not cash. I believe our politicians should show the same courage as the kids, teachers, and first responders showed at Parkland, Sandy Hook, and countless others. It's time for a Congress that fights and runs towards danger and not away from it. Join me at JenningsForCongress.com. Thank you.
Paid for by Adam Jennings for Congress.
Anytime is the right time to update your music collection, so stop in at the Electric Fetus and browse their massive selection. You'll find everything from rock and pop to international and roots, and so much more, on CD and vinyl. Not only is Electric Fetus the best stop for music, but they also carry a wide and unique range of gifts. Bath products, clothing, books, stationery, candles, incense, you name it. That's the Electric Fetus at 2000 4th Avenue South in Minneapolis and online at efetus.com.
Welcome back to the Mike McIntyre Show. Big news here, just coming out. Two anti-gun violence bills are going to get a hearing in the Minnesota legislature in a Minnesota Republican-controlled House Public Safety Committee. One of these is on criminal background checks, and one is on mental health. Chair Representative Brian Johnson had previously refused to give them a hearing. Of course, getting a hearing is not the same as passing a bill. This is all happening this Thursday, March 1st at 10:15 a.m. And of course, you will see it live on the Uptake. And tomorrow, live on the Uptake, the state budget forecast, which will determine where the goalposts are for the state budget. That's at 12:15, and you can watch that live on the Uptake as well. We'll be back here tomorrow with all the news. I'm Mike McIntyre. See you then.